Okay, okay.
Yeah.
So excited. I know.
Yeah.
Hi.
So I'm here to meet Finn, Loki, and Amy. Oh, and Kirsten, the only other human currently in this flat.
Hello.
This is Finn. He's very shy, quite skittish, and an avid bird watcher, the feline kind. He's also soft. So soft. Nothing that abnormal for a cat.
Now we can't get rid of him.
We have cucumber.
You want some too?
Except for his appetite for cucumber, perhaps. Finn was rescued by his cat mum and dad, Kirsten and her partner, alongside his catmate, Loki.
Where has Loki gone?
There.
Loki came from Romania and Finn was found abandoned as a kitten.
He was the most friendly of his siblings, so they paired him with Loki, and because Loki loves everybody, then it worked.
Now they've found their safe forever home with Kirsten, an archivist living with her partner in northwest Cologne, Germany. Loki isn't shy like Finn. He's curious and very friendly.
Hello there.
Then there's the gentle, joyful Amy.
Are you friends?
Amy, come here.
So is she a Labrador?
Yeah.
The 7-year-old chocolate Labrador you can hear groaning in the background. Her nails on the wooden floor and her tail whacking my microphone.
She hates showers, but she loves puddles, dirty puddles especially.
Puddles.
Amy is actually Kirsten's parents' dog, but she hangs out here a lot. Luckily, cats and dogs don't seem to be mortal enemies in this household.
Do you also want to eat something?
Kirsten and her partner consider Finn, Loki, and Amy members of the family. They all eat together at the breakfast table every morning. They share their cucumbers. And the apartment is about a 50-50 mix of human furniture and cat stuff. Their lives largely revolve around caring for their animals and sharing a life with them.
Yes, get some. Come on. Hop. I know. You don't go there often, no?
I'm not very big in traveling, and my boyfriend is neither, so it was perfect for us to have animals and then include them in our lives. It's very comforting coming home and having, well, two animals, and then when the dog is there, three waiting for you, and yeah, it's part of this relationship and part of being loved by them.
There's nothing better than
pets. Kirsten's relationship with her pets is pretty relatable. Very relatable, in fact. Although the kind of pet ownership that we have today has only really been a thing since about the 19th century, keeping pets is now so popular and so widespread, it's seriously difficult to imagine our world without them. And I really mean the world. Nowadays, it's not just for rich people or rich countries, it seems. More than 50% of the world's population is estimated to own a pet. And the country with the most? That's the United States, where 3/4 of people own a pet. In the US, millennials have the most out of any generation, and yes, dogs are the most popular companion, closely followed by cats, then fish. And boy, do people love their animals. Numerous surveys confirm that the vast majority of pet owners consider their pets to be family members. So, when we love them so much and consider them to be, well, relatives, it can be kind of awkward to talk about how pets can be bad environmental choices. Does it even matter? The answer is yes and no. Your pets probably are contributing to environmental harm in ways you might not have thought about. They'll also likely be affected by climate change in ways you might not have considered. But as I found out, they might also hold the key to helping us have a better relationship with the environment. This is Living Planet. I'm Charlie Shield.
Thank you. anybody who loves an animal needs to know this. And I've always said, if you love an animal, then climate change is an issue that you're concerned about.
Angela Frimberger is a trained vet and an advocate, and a cat person.
I'm originally from the US. I did my veterinary training at the University of Pennsylvania, and then I did specialty training as an oncologist at Tufts University in Massachusetts, and practiced as an oncologist at the university there for a number of years before moving to Australia, where I practiced as a veterinary oncologist for another 20 years or so.
Angela isn't treating animals with cancer anymore, though. She's moved on to another major health threat.
I've been very active with an organization called Veterinarians for Climate Action, which was launched in 2019, a group of veterinarians obviously very concerned about the impact of climate change on their patients.
The Vets for Climate Action group Angela is talking about is based in Australia, but it's certainly not the only one. The Veterinary Sustainability Alliance in the US, VetSustain in the UK, and EcoVeto in France are all founded on similar principles. Vets taking action to protect their patients from climate harm.
When I look at the veterinarian's oath that I took when I became a vet, it's clear to me that part of my job is working to stop climate change. So I took an oath to use my scientific knowledge and skills to prevent and relieve animal suffering and protect animal well-being. And climate change clearly falls in the category of things that I need to stop as part of my duty as a veterinarian.
We don't often think about it, Angela says. But the same way that climate change isn't just dangerous for other people and countries and eras out there, it doesn't just affect other animals beyond the protection of our four walls.
There's no place on Earth where animals are safe from the impacts of climate change, and there's no type of animal that's immune to the impacts of climate change. Most people assume that pets are relatively safe from the impacts of climate change, and to some extent they are less vulnerable, but they're not immune. So people don't often realize the extent of the risk that pets are at.
We keep our pets close by. That's kind of the point of them. So it follows that right alongside us, they face many of the same risks that we do from an increasingly extreme and volatile climate. Firstly, there's what Angela calls direct trauma.
So those extreme weather events, they cause food stress, water stress, direct trauma, you know, whether it's being swept up in a flood or being burned in a fire, that's what direct trauma is.
And then there are the ways that our companion animals tend to be more vulnerable to extreme weather, like when it gets hot.
We tend to think of heat as a discomfort rather than a killer, but that's actually not true either. Heat is actually an extremely dangerous stressor physiologically on animals as well as on people.
If it's hot for you, it's probably hotter for your animal. And if you've got a pet with a squished-in face, with long or dark fur, a pet that's especially old or fat or that has cardiac problems, it probably has an elevated risk of heat stroke. Vets advise to never leave your pet in the car, even for a few minutes, to keep pets indoors and cool on very hot days, and to be careful not to make them walk on hot asphalt. The fact that pets can have a harder time regulating their body temperature than us is also one reason Angela points out that if you are getting a dog or a cat, it's really important to choose a breed that actually suits the climate that you live in.
So if you live in a cold climate, if you choose an Italian Greyhound, he's going to need a lot of heat, right? Conversely, if you live in a warm climate like I do, don't choose a Malamute that's going to be hot all the time and is going to need to have fans and air conditioners running to keep him from getting heat stroke.
And while pets don't necessarily have to worry about habitat loss like wild animals do, after all, their habitats are usually your home, unlike wild animals, they are vulnerable to something called socioeconomic stress during crisis periods, like after a hurricane or a wildfire or a flood rips through a town.
Oftentimes following these events, people need to cut costs, even though hopefully, you know, there's insurance and whatnot, it still costs a lot of money. And so that can include the cost of caring for their animals.
Rising temperatures and changing climates are also increasing the spread of diseases.
We're seeing warmer, wetter weather farther away from the equator, what we call poleward. That changes the distribution of a lot of infectious diseases.
Animals responding to these dramatic changes in their ecosystems are moving to different regions, giving pathogens more chances to jump between animal hosts.
A lot of diseases that were previously considered tropical diseases are now being seen in areas that are farther away from the equator. And some of those are really substantial.
Mosquitoes, ticks, biting flies and midges carrying various pathogens are looking for new homes in new places. Homes that could be your pets.
Those arthropod vectors are able to travel over much broader areas, to much higher altitudes, and over a much longer period of the year than they have been in previous times.
Pets also eat food cultivated and produced alongside our own. Food that's becoming harder to grow and harder to rely on.
We might see that heat, drought, storms will impact on crops that are being grown. And even if they don't destroy the harvest, they might reduce the nutritional quality of the crop, or they might make it so that the plants are more vulnerable to diseases and pests. So the net effect is food insecurity.
As climate change has accelerated, there's been a sharp rise in the drought, heat, storms and floods that Angela is talking about, especially over the past 20 years. One report from the United Nations found that the number of extreme weather events recorded between the year 2000 and 2019 jumped by 83% compared to the previous two decades. Major floods more than doubled, while severe storms rose by 40%. No continent has been spared a rise in these extremes, but Asia has seen the highest number of climate-related disasters according to this data. Our cats and our dogs, our rabbits, chickens, hamsters, guinea pigs, birds, fish and reptiles are right beside us in the climate crisis firing line. That much is clear. But how could our sweet, supportive and innocent pets possibly contribute to harming the environment and worsening the climate crisis? Pets don't vote in elections. They're not fooled into buying stuff that they don't need. They don't fall for conspiracy theories or even drive SUVs. That's partly why they're so lovable. They're simple, non-judgmental creatures who don't have to think about any of that stuff. Pets, of course, are not really the architects of their environmental footprints, or paw prints, as those in the business call it. We are.
People, I guess, have a bit of a blind spot, perhaps, with their pets. You know, they think they know they need to reduce their international travel and have a smaller car and change their own diets, but they're not necessarily thinking about their pets in the same way.
And what would your response be to people who heard about this research and this topic, the environmental impact of owning pets, and thought, you know, do we really have to go there? Can we not have anything nice these days?
Well, you know, we are living in a time of crisis, right? And I think we need to think about all forms of consumption and environmental impact that we have, and that needs to include our pets.
So what is a pet's main climate crime? Well, it's the same as yours, food. Namely, the meat they eat, should they be meat eaters. Because just like for humans, the more meat a pet eats, the more land, water, feed, pesticides, and emissions are involved, and the bigger the impact on the climate. Peter Alexander researches and teaches global food systems at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. His research focuses on what we eat, how we produce it, and how we transport it. And initially, when pet food came up as a topic to investigate, he wasn't that interested.
Collaborators of mine and I were sort of arguing about whether we should consider pets. And I guess I was on the side of the argument to say that it probably wasn't that important because you know, the amount they eat is relatively small compared to humans. And more importantly, a lot of what they eat is byproducts, kind of commodities that are being produced anyway and maybe wouldn't have found a very other natural sort of purpose. And therefore, we just could focus on the human consumption.
But then some research came out that made him reconsider.
I partly changed my mind in reaction to some work that was published about 6 or 7 years ago now, I think.
A frequently referenced study published out of the University of California in 2017 that quantified the environmental impact of cat and dog food in the US. That study found that feeding cats and dogs in the United States generates the equivalent of 64 million tons of carbon dioxide every year. About the same as 12.5 million cars driving on the road over a year.
And it came up with some fairly, in my view, extreme numbers of something like a third of emissions associated with food in the US was related to pets.
According to Peter, the US study ended up with such a big number because the researchers didn't correctly account for the fact that pet food meat is made from byproducts.
So we kind of went away and thought, well, we can do something different here. We can do something that's more reasonable that accounts for the fact that these are byproducts. And yeah, we published a paper.
His team's paper, published in 2020, found that dry pet food, which makes up 80% of the market, accounted for 2% of global agricultural emissions. So up to about 150 million tons of carbon dioxide every year across the world. Had his team also included wet food, which has a bigger impact, Peter says the total figure would be about 4 to 5% of global agricultural emissions.
So we're talking more like 1 or 2% of anthropogenic emissions overall. Now, that's not huge in a sense, but it's still significant and growing as the number of pets that we have globally is growing.
They also calculated that an area double the size of the UK is needed to make dry food for the dogs and cats of the world.
So we need to think about how we can reduce that. And also it's very variable depending on how we feed our animals. So that if we feed them products that are higher in meat, in prime cuts of meat particularly, then they will be associated with higher emissions.
And that last point about how we feed our animals is an important one, Angela says.
Many of us have gotten in the habit of wanting to feed our animals the way that we want to eat because we love our animals and we consider them to be members of the family. And so we want to feed them food that would be appetizing to us. That's not actually necessarily what they want. That's just us kind of projecting our desires onto them.
Meat byproducts are perfectly nutritious, as can be other protein sources, such as insects, which are increasingly being used to make pet food, and non-meat options as well. Cats are obligate carnivores, meaning they do need to eat meat. But dogs can, in theory, forgo meat altogether, though Angela strongly recommends developing a vegan dog diet in close consultation with its vet, because it can be tricky and different dogs have different needs. And
obviously, don't feed them more food than they need. A lot of us overfeed our dogs. They will be healthier and feel better if they're not overweight, and they'll be causing less climate impacts with the food if you're not overfeeding them.
Then, of course, what goes in must come out. The way we deal with pet poop, especially that of cats and dogs, can not only be bad for human health, but a real environmental hazard. Left outside, it can transmit diseases and add harmful levels of phosphorus and nitrogen to the environment. Buried near waterways or chucked in the sea, and the bacteria from dog poo can release pathogens into the groundwater and cause algal blooms. But bagged and binned, pet poo can be a major contributor to methane gas emissions when it's sent to landfill. And although it depends where you live, it's not always a good idea to flush your pet's poop alongside human waste. Instead, if you can manage it, one of the most ecologically sensitive ways to dispose of this is to compose it in a biodegradable bag in a high-temperature compost heap. Then there's all the stuff you can get for your pet. The bits and bobs. You know what I'm talking about. Bows, balls, sweaters, prams, paddle pools, lotions, potions, even aromatherapy. And yes, some of this stuff they need, just like humans need some stuff. But when our love for our pets meets capitalism's greed to exploit it, it can get kind of ridiculous.
All the stuff. We have all, as a society, gotten in a habit of shopping a lot for ourselves, and we're now shopping a lot for our pets.
We certainly are. These days, the global pet industry is worth about $303 billion. Most of that is food, sure, but it also includes things like perfume, designer shampoos, spas, massages, nail polish, tuxedos, coloured styling gels, and even prosthetic dog testicles and dog sex toys.
People say love is the international language. No, pets are the international language.
Invest in a pet carrier or travel accessories that prioritize comfort and style for on-the-go pampering.
This washable ball rotates over your clothes, picking up and removing your dog's hair. Feed your fur babies with one tug using this automatic food dispenser from Houndsville.
Invest in high-quality supplements or wellness products tailored to your pet's specific needs.
We're all for pets.
What do luxury and indulgence actually mean to a pet, though? Likely something different from what it means to us. Take it from Angela Frimberger.
If you're going to own an animal, then you have taken on the responsibility to make sure that that animal is as safe and well cared for as it can be. But there's a difference between that and overbuying accessories and things that don't really contribute to the animal's quality of life, but more contribute to the pet owner's impulse to buy, impulse to consume. Because pets don't have that.
Because after all they really want is
love, time, play, interaction. Yeah, they want their owners to be with them.
Basically, the more we humanize domestic animals, the worse their environmental paw prints seem to become. But listen, none of this, Angela underscores, is to vilify pet owners.
We're certainly not in the business of making people feel guilty because they love an animal. That pet's a member of the family. And I am not going to demonize a member of your family. Pet owning has so many positive upsides.
And, Angela adds, it's also important to step back a little from the paw print predicament to not lose sight of the bigger fish that need frying in the climate fight.
All of this is a tiny fraction of the problem. Yes, we should do our best, absolutely. But if we don't stop extracting and burning fossil fuels, it's not going to change the problem. If all of us stopped owning pets tomorrow, but fossil fuel companies kept doing what they're doing, we will have made our sacrifice for nothing.
And being a pet owner isn't some black mark against your name as far as climate action is concerned, she says.
We do need to ask business and industry and government to lead the way. There are some commentators who might say things like, well, you know, if you're going to keep driving that car, or if you're going to keep eating a cheeseburger from time to time, or if you're going to keep owning that dog, then you don't have a right to criticize others on climate change. And I disagree, because I'm not perfect. I try to do my best, but I'm not perfect. But that doesn't mean that I don't have a right to say, yes, but the fossil fuel industry has profited billions and billions and billions of dollars since we've known about this.
We'll be back in just a moment.
It's overwhelming to think about the future that climate change will bring. That's why this season of How We Survive, a podcast from Marketplace, offers simple, everyday changes you can make now to prepare for the future. Hear from experts about climate-friendly diets, evaluating climate risks in your neighborhood, electrifying your home, and so much more. Join us and learn how to keep climate despair at bay. Listen to How We Survive wherever you get your podcasts.
Could pets even help? Well, yeah, that's one theory. Okay, so your Pomeranian isn't about to campaign for a solar switch, nor is your ragdoll going to revolutionize public transportation in your city. But
one idea I had is that if we could increase our bond with animals, pets for example, that it may also translate into a better or a more intense connection with nature. So that was one of the key reasons I got interested in studying our relationship with animals. My name is Pim Mortens. I'm a professor of sustainable development for the last several 18 years, but recently I became professor of planetary health at Maastricht University in the Netherlands. So I'm doing a lot of work relating to the health of our planet and everything on it, including humans, animals, and plants.
Another of Pim Martin's worthy credentials includes Cat Dad. He knows what it's like to love and care for a pet, and he's also done a bunch of research into human-animal relationships. And Pim thinks that across much of the world, something has gone wrong with these relationships. And that's a big reason for the declining health of the planet.
I do feel that we are losing our connection with nature, and the way we treat animals is definitely a sign of that.
In many ways, humans' relationships to animals seem kind of paradoxical nowadays. We're obsessed with our pets. We cuddle them, coddle them, dress them up and show them off. And then there are a whole range of other animals that we put in cages, force feed, force breed, milk, pluck and slaughter.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think by having pets and treating them in the way we do, I think it's also a somewhat a sign of how we are disconnected from nature, but still how we want to interact with animals, because I think that's also part of our nature. We are part of a bigger scheme, and everybody that has a cat or a dog or other pets, we have that for a reason. We want to connect with other living beings, not only humans, but also other living beings.
This loss of connection with the natural world is having all kinds of profound knock-on effects, Pim points out. Wildlife populations have, on average, declined by 70% over the past 50 years. Deforestation is robbing animals of their habitats and the earth of one of its most fundamental methods of carbon removal. Diseases are increasingly making the jump from animals to humans.
So I think every little thing matters in terms of impact, but for me, the most important thing is that I would really like people to think about these things. Again, not saying that get rid of your pets, no, but realize that they do have an impact.
Part of Pim's research involved exploring to what extent human relationships with pets could translate into caring for the natural world, as well as different cultural attitudes towards other creatures. And there was one that resonated with him particularly strongly.
A third part of my work is actually asking indigenous people about their perception, how we should interact with animals. And they have a somewhat different perspective. I think a more natural view on how we should interact with animals. They also usually, they shoot some animals, they eat them, but in a more natural way. They don't overshoot animals. They don't have animals in cages like we have. They try to think about time of the year they shoot them. They eat everything, so don't shoot more than they need, etc. So I really hope that our empathy towards our pets will also form the bridge to empathy to non-pets, like animals in the wild, and then our empathy towards nature. At least that's my maybe naive hope in focusing on our bond with animals.
Yes, you can have some. Yes, I know. That was unfair, I know. You have to come up or the dog gets it.
For Kirsten, her pets are both an anchor to home life and a bridge to the world beyond. Even if that's just to parts of it that have kind of been staring her in the face anyway.
You get to go out more when you have a dog. You get to experience more. And you also recognize more. For example, the cats, they don't go outside, but they can see the birds from the windows. And when they watch them, you can just sit next to them and also watch the birds. And I don't know how many people sit at their windows in their homes and watch for birds in their trees just right outside the window. And I think you get a connection even when you don't expect it. Look, you get something after that. You don't like cucumbers.
The reality is that owning fewer pets would reduce stress on the environment. But experts like Angela, Pim, and Peter aren't suggesting you live a life without them. Pets bring joy and health benefits into many people's lives, like lowered stress levels and lower blood pressure. They can force us out into the world, help us see the magic in the ordinary, and show us uncomplicated love.
That's why I became a veterinarian, and that's why so many people love animals, because of the sheer innocent joy of the human-animal bond. There's nothing to rival the affection of an animal in a person's life.
These animals that we keep by our side and call our own are, after all, creatures of this earth, just like us. It would just be helpful if we didn't try to make them too much like us. Perfumed, accessorized, overfed, and overdressed. Or to exclude them from efforts to minimize pollution and tackle climate change.
You did good. Yes. Yes. Very great.
This episode of Living Planet was written and produced by me, Charlie Shield. It was edited and put together by Neil King and fine-tuned in the studio by Jürgen Kuhn. Thank you so much for listening. If you liked this episode, we'd love to know. Give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or another podcast app. And remember, you can send us voice notes with your ideas and your feedback anytime to livingplanet@dw.com. We'll be back with a new episode next week.